Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 13, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The World Bank projects slow economic growth in sub-Saharan Africa in 2023.
African countries need to really, really put all the effort to stabilize their economies. There's a real risk now that we might face an economic crisis that is going to be related to debt.
U.S. officials reaffirm Washington's commitment to Africa's development in the financial technology sector. The UN says its mission in Mali remains essential for stability and security. Tunisian police clear a UNHCR camp with violence and tear gas. Malawi's president bemoans Cyclone Freddy's impact on the economy and livelihoods.
This devastating climate change event has killed over 1,000 people, displaced over 500,000, and affected over 2 million through the washing away of homes, roads, businesses, and power lines.
And a former Uganda government minister is denied bail for insufficient guarantors. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The World Bank says economic growth in sub-Saharan Africa will slow from 3.6% to 3.1% in 2023. In a report released ahead of this week's spring meetings of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank in Washington, D.C., the World Bank says the projection is brought on by uncertainty in the global economy, a sharp decline in investments, and rising debt levels. Andrew Dabalin is the World Bank's chief economist for Africa. He tells me that African governments must sharpen their macroeconomic stability, domestic revenue collection, and debt reduction to reduce extreme poverty and boost prosperity in the medium to long term.
So let's say Africa is a patient and they came in 6 months ago for a checkup, and now this is a follow-up. Okay, so in this follow-up, what we are saying is that the conditions for economic activity remain sluggish. We project growth to decline from about 3.6 to 3.1%. And that is primarily because of the underperformance of some of the big economies in the region, like South Africa, Nigeria, Angola.
What are some of the factors responsible for the picture you've just painted?
A few things really stand out. One is African countries depend a lot on trade, trading in, you know, few commodities, minerals, agricultural goods. So the weak global demand is a major reason why growth is being dragged down. Investment underperformance is another one. Inflation has peaked, but it remains very high. And, you know, when inflation is very high, you know, consumption is lowered, investments are lower, and so economic activity in general gets dragged down. Then there is this really, really high interest rates that are happening in rich countries that are spilling over into what African countries can do. And then finally, there's a lot of high debt, which basically takes away the ability to borrow domestically to finance core development issues.
How can Africa get out of this debt distress or trap other than an outright debt forgiveness?
Certainly, you know, debt restructuring for some countries is going to be an option. But short of that, what other things can African countries do? One thing they can do is, of course, to rationalize how they spend what they control, right? So domestic resources that they control. The other thing they can do is, of course, is to really focus on growth, because once you grow, you're going to be able to actually have more businesses come into the economy, and they can generate more revenues for you.
Earlier this week, I read a news article in which a Chinese government official called on the United States to make a greater effort to address Africa's debt crisis. A number of African countries have begun borrowing from China. What is the difference between a Chinese government loan and, say, for example, the IMF or World Bank loan?
So I don't have details of how the Chinese loans are made. But what I can tell you is I can tell you about some of the ways in which the World Bank and IMF types of loans are made. And in some ways, that may give you some point about ways in which this could be different. So in our case, what we usually do is for very, very poor countries, we give them grants. They don't have to repay them, especially countries that are in very high debt distress and are poor. Second, a lot of our loans, especially for low-income countries, are concessional. What usually that means for your audience is that these are loans that are taken for something like, you don't have to repay them for 30, 40, maybe sometimes, you know, 50 years, and very low interest rates.
How can Africa fight back to deal with this current economic challenges? After all, the continent is still rich in resources. How can it fight back?
Exactly. So several ways Africa can actually try to get out of this. I'm going to recommend some things that sound very standard recommendations, but actually they are really the right recommendations. One is African countries need to really, really put all the effort to stabilize their economies. There's a real risk now that we might face an economic crisis that is going to be related to debt. The second thing African countries can do is to do a lot more in, be very aggressive in the way they reform their economies, especially when it comes to, you know, how to increase productivity of their agricultural sector, how to increase the inflow of private investments, because, you know, government revenues are going to be challenged in this environment when borrowing costs are high. So it's important to bring in a lot more private investment for jobs, for poverty reduction. And then finally, it's really, really important for Africans to invest in a third engine of growth. One engine of growth has been this global trade, which now looks very weak and uncertain and potentially fragmented. Another one has been the domestic market. But now we have this continental free trade. So that should be the third engine of growth that becomes really, really powerful as a blueprint for development for the region.
Thank you so much. A pleasure speaking with you. Well appreciated.
Thank you so much, James.
That's Andrew Dabalin, World Bank Chief Economist for Africa. You're speaking with us from Washington, D.C., where the spring meetings of the IMF World Bank are taking place. U.S. officials on Wednesday reaffirmed Washington's commitment to partnering with Africa in the continent's development, especially in the financial technology sector, the continent's fastest-growing industry. VOA's Mike Hovey attended the 2023 Africa FinTech Summit, which brought together delegates from over 50 nations, many of them from Africa. He spoke to Rami Tulu, the Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of Economic and Business Affairs at the U.S. Department of State, about U.S. investments in Africa.
At the Africa Leaders, U.S. Africa Leaders Summit in December, President Biden emphasized the importance that the U.S. attaches to a partnership with Africa to unlock the enormous potential on the continent. And one component of that is the digital economy. We've learned around the world that digital connectivity unleashes extraordinary economic potential. And through a new initiative, Digital Transformation in Africa Initiative, the U.S. government is seeking to partner with African countries, the private sector, and small businesses to try to expand connectivity in Africa and expand the use of digital tools to unleash this economic potential.
Why choose to support Africa?
U.S. has strong connections to Africa through diaspora that are in the United States. Africa has, you know, historically had problems of food insecurity, continues to have the need for economic development. And so the U.S. wants to be a partner in unlocking some of that potential to raise living standards, to provide more economic opportunity, to strengthen food security. And the digital transformation can be a part of realizing all of these objectives.
Now, to go back to, I guess, infrastructure, the development of Africa, those are some of the challenges that the continent is facing. And of course, the U.S. is investing in that. Could you tell us more about how that would improve the continent's fintech sector?
Sure. Basically, lots of economic activity depends upon connections. So traditional economic activity, connections through roads. You need to be able to get goods to market. The partnership that the U.S. has with Africa on physical infrastructure is intended to address that component. Mm-hmm. But with the modern economy, that digital connectivity and digital infrastructure is also incredibly important. And so what we're looking to do is partner with African countries not only to get that physical infrastructure that's necessary for the digital economy, but also to connect entrepreneurs with one another, connect those entrepreneurs with financing so that we can upscale various important financial innovations, including in the fintech sector, to benefit all Africans.
I really want to delve a little into the DTI itself. How can young entrepreneurs in the fintech industry from the continent tap into that?
Well, one way is through events like the Fintech Summit. And when we hosted the U.S. Africa Leaders Summit, we also had an innovators gathering. What we call the convening power of the U.S. government is an opportunity to bring together these young entrepreneurs and have them meet representatives from Google, representatives from MasterCard, who are also in attendance at events like this today. Another mechanism is through various programs that the U.S. government has to catalyze private investment. So our U.S. International Development Finance Corporation and USAID have programs that can help encourage private sector investment in small businesses. So those are a couple of the different mechanisms that we're hoping to expand through this new initiative.
That was Ramin Tulu, the Assistant Secretary of the Bureau of Economic and Business Affairs at the U.S. Department of State. He spoke to VOA's Mike Hovey at the Washington Convention Center. The United Nations Security Council says the continuing support of the UN mission in Mali, also known as MINUSMA, is essential for the country's stability and security. In his report to the Council on Wednesday, Secretary General El-Gassim Wan said Mali has seen an increase in attacks by Islamic extremists in the central region, where at least 206 people have been killed and 80 injured between January and March 2023. For VOA News, Kwangu Liwewe reports from Washington, D.C.
After almost a decade of faltering counterinsurgency efforts in Mali, the security situation in the country continues to deteriorate. After falling out with Mali's military government's alleged use of Russian mercenaries with the Wagner Group, France and its European allies pulled out their forces, which were fighting the Islamist insurgents. That left behind the United Nations peacekeeping mission, MINUSMA, to handle the deteriorating security situation. The Malian government has, however, not been accommodating MINUSMA. It's denied nearly 300 flight requests this year, expelled the mission's human rights chief, and refused to issue visas to the UN Mali panel of experts. The United Kingdom's representative to the UN, Barbara Woodward, says this is unacceptable.
This reflects a worrying disregard for the mission's mandate. We count on the mission's continued commitment to investigate and report on human rights. In this regard, we urge the release without further delay of the UN report on the alleged massacre of civilians in Moura by Malian armed forces.
But the Secretary General of the UN Security Council, El-Hassim Wain, says despite these challenges, the protection of civilians remains a top priority.
I remain convinced that the United Nations offers the best framework to support the lasting stabilization of Mali and the larger Sahel region in close partnership with the African Union and ECOWAS.
Ghana's permanent representative to the UN, Harold Adelaye Ajaman, commented on Mali's path to restoring democracy following the military coup in 2020. He said that it is worrying that not much progress has been made and that the government postponed the constitutional referendum, which was scheduled for March 2023.
It is important that the remaining time be effectively organized to realize the institutional reforms and fulfill the electoral commitment.
With MINUSMA's mandate expiring in June, what's left to be seen is whether the military government will work to further frustrate the mission to ensure that its mandate is not extended. Many observers feel the move could worsen civil and political strife. For VOA Africa, I'm Kwangu Liwewe in Washington.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 13. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera says Cyclone Freddy killed more than 1,000 people and severely impacted the country's economy. President Chakwera made his comments on Wednesday when he officially opened this year's tobacco marketing season in the capital, Lilongwe. Economic experts say revenues from tobacco make up over 60% of the country's foreign exchange earnings. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, Malawi.
President Chakwera says the cyclone, which also hit Mozambique and Madagascar, has shattered the economy and livelihoods.
This devastating climate change event has killed over 1,000 people, displaced over 500,000, and affected over 2 million through the washing away of homes, roads, bridges, crops, markets, schools, clothes, businesses, and power lines.
Malawi government statistics show that Cyclone Freddy has also killed 194,500 livestock and submerged or washed away over 200,000 hectares of land. President Chakwera says he cannot sugarcoat the truth about what the country can do to turn things and revive the economy. Chakwera says Malawi can only retain its macroeconomic stability by increasing the quantity, the variety, and the quality of goods for export to the global market.
The primary and priority sectors in which we must work harder, smarter, and together to increase productivity are agriculture, tourism, and mining. This is what I have referred to as our ATM strategy.
Over 80% of Malawi's population depends on agriculture, particularly tobacco, which accounts more than half of the country's foreign exchange earnings.
In fact, if all the tobacco farmers stopped producing tobacco today, the economy would collapse. Tobacco farmers are the ones making it possible for the rest of us to wear imported clothes, buy imported fuel, take imported medicine, travel abroad, watch foreign channels on our television, ride in imported cars, and so forth.
However, farmers have long complained of low market prices for tobacco, which they say prevent them from improving their lives. On the first day of tobacco sales Wednesday, some farmers called for suspending sales after noting that buyers were purchasing the crop for as low as $1 per kilogram. However, industry experts attribute the lower prices to low quality tobacco, which they would like to see improved. Godfrey Chapola is the chairperson for the Tobacco Commission in Malawi.
Let me commend our buying companies for their role in the better prices offered last year. As a Tobacco Commission, we see a very exciting marketing season ahead of us because of the projected increase in production. It is our hope that this year the prices will even be better than in 2022, considering the high cost of production.
Chapola says tobacco production has increased by half compared to last year, a development which could indicate sound economic growth. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Tunisian police used violence and tear gas on Tuesday this week to drive out refugees and migrants encamped outside the offices of the UN Refugee Agency, resulting in a number of casualties who were taken to hospitals. The Ministry of Interior says they were responding to the request from UNHCR and arrested 80 people. While in police detention, many have suffered violent beatings and injuries, and some 20 people have been remanded into prison. But the charges are not clear. Reporter Alicia Folkman has more from Tunis.
Migrants and UNHCR registered refugees have been encamped for some weeks now outside UNHCR's offices in Tunis. Many were made homeless in a wave of violence that swept the nation following inflammatory and racially provocative statements by the country's president, Kais Saied, back in February. The camp had become a sit-in demonstration. Days before the police clearing the camp, migrants and refugees had sent videos to Voice of America showing tensions rising between them and police. But Tuesday, the situation erupted into full-scale conflict. UNHCR said in a press release that some refugees, asylum seekers and migrants forcibly entered its premises, causing some material damage and leading to tense interactions with the local police force. Police said they were simply responding to a request for help from UNHCR, which the UN agency strenuously denied. denies. In a statement to Voice of America, UNHCR's spokesperson said the police officers in front of the office were deployed to patrol the demonstration since it started on 21st of March to ensure law and order for all parties. A Nigerian migrant who holds a degree in public health care said he witnessed provocation by police.
So one of them is trying to video the woman, so she's doing some choice. So she told the police not to video, take her from there.
So before I know, the police slapped the woman. When the police slapped the woman started screaming. The one of the Sudanese, I think her husband, came out and said, "Why will you slap my wife? Why will you slap my wife?" From there, the other Sudanese came out and the fight started. Everything were out of hand.
Many witnesses who spoke to Voice of America, including this Nigerian migrant, said that although violence erupted on both sides, he saw police firing a large number of canisters of tear gas and beating people.
I couldn't count it. Many. Many people were affected by the tear gas. The Sudanese guy, he fainted here. The guy was trying to calm the issue down. The guy was trying to calm the people, his people down, not to fight.
A number of videos shared on social media show those running away from UNHCR and injuries they say that are from police violence.
You hear her, brother? They beat him this morning. See blood on him. See blood on him. See him. Oh, God. We're not in this country. This country is not safe for us. We need evacuation. We need evacuation.
In another video circulated by migrants on social media, shows a large number of black people running over a motorway bridge.
Police are chasing us. They injure a lot of people, harass the ladies. As you can see, they are still pursuing us. They're after our lives.
A refugee from Darfur, Sudan, who had fainted from tear gas, said he was beaten by police and described some people being hurt with batons emitting electric shocks. He said that 20 of the 80 people arrested by the police are now in jail. The Darfurian refugee said the police accused these 20 men of being criminals and said that amongst them is his friend, a Sierra Leonean migrant called Josephus Thompson, who is one of the camp's leading advocates calling for evacuation from Tunisia.
Yes, they put us in the police station, then they took other guys, like 20 persons. That I know them by their faces, and they took them to the jail. And they said, those, they are criminals.
The Darfurian refugee says he is frightened that police will continue to follow him and that he is not safe from arrest inside the camp, and he wants to get out of Tunisia. Those who remain in the camp, including the wives, friends and sisters of the men who have been taken to jail, say that although things are calmer, they still feel very unsafe and are frightened. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Alicia Faultman in Tunis, Tunisia.
An anti-corruption court in Uganda on Wednesday denied bail to former government minister Mary Gariti Kitutu for lack of substantial sureties. She was arrested and jailed for allegedly diverting iron sheets meant for the vulnerable residents of Uganda's Karamoja region. The judge said three of her sponsors, including her husband, failed to show proof of financial support. Attorney Robert Apenya explains to me the importance of surety or bail guarantees in criminal proceedings.
From what I understand, the Honorable Minister Chitutu, through her lawyers, made an application for bail, which is her constitutional right as enshrined in our constitution. So she made an application. From what we've seen, the court declined to grant her bail. One of the overriding reasons that the court gave is that she did not have substantial surety.
What does the court mean by substantial surety? What is that?
Well, just very quickly, surety is a person who has one key role, and that key role is to ensure that an accused person attends court as and when required of them to attend. So, for example, if you're an accused person, there are certain criteria that you must be able to prove in order to convince court, and those considerations vary from offense to offense, but generally you have to, for example, the court will put into consideration the nature of the accusation against the person, the gravity of the offense, whether the accused person has a fixed place of abode, that's a home within the jurisdictional area where the court is hearing the matter from, and whether the accused may have a likelihood to interfere with the investigation or with witnesses. Now, in addition to those that I've mentioned, one of the grounds that the court considers is that you must have substantial sureties. And what sureties do is that they ensure that an accused person can attend court. The law is silent on what amounts to substantial. It's a question of fact, and each court will determine it on its merit as is before it. For example, the court will look at the person who is standing surety may look at your standing in society, your financial ability, your record of employment, or just what you do generally.
Attorney Robert Apenya explains to me the importance of surety or bail guarantees in criminal proceedings. And that's it for this Thursday, April 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guests this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barty in Washington saying, have a great day.